Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, gay radio for San Francisco and beyond. I'm Eric Jansen. This week, gay men bringing children into their families with surrogate mothers. After adoption, it's pretty much the only option for gay men, having no wombs of our own. But it's expensive, and there are plenty of legal complications and medical ones, too. You'll hear all about it in the next half hour. With us, three gay men representing two families. One couple had twin girls 4.5 years ago. They're healthy and happy now, but Zola and Veronica were born more than 3 months premature, before the start of the third trimester, and the family went through quite an ordeal at the time. Papa's written a book about their experience called Papa and Daddy and Babies in Alaska, and Papa and Daddy are both here to talk with us. John Cruz and Gary Bouchel, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Hi, thanks. Hello.
Our other guest also had twins, a boy and a girl, just over a year old now, and also with his partner found a surrogate mom to bring their offspring into the world. And for them, too, there were some complications. Ed Sweet, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Thanks.
And thanks to all three of you for being here. Gary and John, I want to start with you. You went through an expensive and, I'm sure, very emotionally trying time. And I'm just painting this with a hugely broad brush here. You expected your children would be born here in California, but they ended up in Alaska in neonatal intensive care for their first 3 months of life, weighing less than 2 pounds each at birth. And Gary, you ended up staying with these tiny infants, your girls, in Alaska without John for most of that time. As you describe in your book, not really knowing if they'd survive and if they did, what kind of problems they may have.
Sure.
So I want to ask you both, John and Gary, what was going through your minds as you flew up to Alaska after learning that your surrogate mom had gone into labor 3 months early after complications that you knew she was having?
We were so afraid that something would go wrong with the birth and they might not survive, or if they did survive, it would be with some terrible disability that would affect them for the rest of their lives.
And John?
And we also had worries about how competent medical care might be in Alaska, even though we were in Providence Hospital in Anchorage, which is the biggest city in Alaska, and we didn't know how we would be accepted as a gay couple.
Mm-hmm. Now, how was it that the babies ended up being born in Alaska? Originally, the plan was you found a surrogate mother specifically here in California so that she would be born here, and what was the reason for that?
Well, some judges do pre-birth declarations that you are both fathers are the legal parents, and we go right on the birth certificates as the parents and do not have to go through second father adoption. And so that's...
If they'd been born right here in California.
If they had been born in California. So that's why we wanted to do it in California.
And so what happened? The surrogate ended up moving to Alaska?
Right, and we got along so well with her that we decided to continue using her, and she agreed to move back to California for the last 2 months of the pregnancy so that the girls would be sure to be born in California.
But things didn't turn out that way.
No, it didn't.
So what happened? Go ahead, John.
5 months into the pregnancy, they discovered she had an incompetent cervix and they put a stitch through the cervix, so hopefully it wouldn't open up early and she'd deliver early, but that also meant she had to be on bed rest, and not just bed rest at home, but bed rest in the hospital for the rest of the pregnancy.
And what does incompetent cervix mean?
The cervix is the end of the uterus, which is supposed to stay closed and hard and firm until the baby's ready to come out, and then it goes through a process of softening and widening, dilating, so that the baby can come down the birth canal in a normal fashion. And with Kathy, our surrogate, they detected, again, at the 5-month prenatal checkup, that it was already dilating and softening, essentially.
Okay, so they basically did some medical procedures to try to
They kept her in stitches.
Zola and Veronica, yeah, okay, inside as long as they could, but it didn't quite hold. So, how small were they when you first saw them? I mean, I said they were under 2 pounds each, but what did that look like to you?
Like little mole rats, just so tiny they could fit in the palm of your hand.
Yeah, their palm on their hand was smaller than my fingernails. In addition to just being small, what's hard to appreciate is babies that early don't have any subcutaneous fat, so they're not just small roly-poly things. They look kind of like small Holocaust survivors because they're skin and bones and long, thin limbs, not like, again, a short, chubby baby or a small, chubby baby. They're skinny and bright.
Like little stick figures.
So that must have been incredibly scary.
Horribly scary.
Yeah.
We've never been through anything like that before. We're totally lost.
Yeah, I can imagine. Do you want to read a short section, Gary, from your book?
Sure.
This is that one on page 51. You had described before that how you got to the hospital. You flew up on a Friday and didn't really know how quickly Kathy would deliver, your surrogate. There was some little bit of misunderstanding about whether or not Kathy wanted you in the room when she was actually delivering or not, right?
Right. Yeah, we had agreed ahead of time that we could be in the room, and Kathy assured us that we could be. But as it turned out, there was some misunderstanding, and the nurses wouldn't let us in the room with Kathy. They said it was too small, we couldn't be there. And so we had to wait down the hall in a waiting room.
So why don't you start with that, in the middle of that page 51 there. Read that paragraph to us and then flip to page 53.
Yeah, and indeed, only after the births, about 40 minutes after the girls had been cleaned up, were we informed of the births and led into the NICU to see Veronica and Zola. It was with feelings of thrill and pride and wonder and love and gravity and helplessness that we saw our daughters for the first time, hooked up to the machines that could keep them alive in the controlled high-tech environment of their incubators that would be their surrogate wombs for the coming weeks. Oh, and regret. We deeply regret that we missed being in the delivery room for their births, for their first breaths, for their first cries, for their first reactions to their strange new world. So in the first minutes of life, Zola and Veronica were assessed using the Apgar score to determine how critical their condition was. The Apgar score was developed in 1952 by Virginia Apgar of Columbia University to enable doctors to quickly determine how much help a newborn needs to stay alive. Babies are measured on how well they are breathing, 2 points for vigorous breaths and crying, 1 point for weak breaths, and no points if they're not breathing at all. How they respond to an irritant like a puff of air up the nostril. There's 2 points for a strong reaction like sneezing, 1 point for just making a face, and no points if no reaction. And how well they move their arms and legs. 2 points for moving them, 1 point for just flexing them, and no points if they're limp. And how well their hearts are beating. 2 points for a pulse of 100 or over, 1 point if it's less than 100, and no points if no pulse. And how good their skin color is, 2 points for normal color all over, 1 point if the hands and feet are blue, and no point if they're blue all over. These 5 measures are added up to provide an Apgar score of 0 to 10 points. Babies scoring 7 and up are generally fine. At 4 to 7, they might need some help. And 3 and under, and they require immediate help. Zola scored 6 at 1 minute after birth and 8 at 5 minutes. Veronica scored 2 at 1 minute, 4 at 5 minutes, and 6 at 10 minutes. They needed some help, and they had come to the right place.
Thank you. That's Gary Bushell reading from his book Papa and Daddy and Babies in Alaska. You're tuned to Out in the Bay, Gay Radio for San Francisco and beyond. I'm Eric Jansen. My guests are Gary Bushell, his partner John Cruz, and Ed Sweet. And we're talking about gay men using surrogate mothers to bring their children into the world. So we've heard a little bit from Gary and John about their daughters, Zola and Veronica. So, Ed, if you could tell us, your daughter also had some complications at birth. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Roxanne was born what is considered term, Roxanne and Wiley, a term at 35 weeks, but Roxanne was very low birth weight. She only weighed 3.5 pounds, whereas her brother was 6¾ pounds. And the exact reason for that has really never been determined. It's been explained that the placenta was, for one reason or another, not sufficient.
So are there risks associated with going the surrogate mother route?
There are risks in having children, no matter how you have them. And I think that, you know, it's just an important point, whether, you know, it's a traditional family having children, or whether you're adopting children or having children through a surrogacy arrangement. It requires a lot of, I think, faith and acceptance and belief that things will go well, but no certainties. The biggest risks, I think, in the surrogacy arrangement tend to be around the risks involved in vitro fertilization in general, and those are particularly pronounced in situations where there are multiple pregnancies.
And it's fairly typical, is it not, for in vitro fertilization clinics to purposely implant more than one embryo to enhance the success rates, to enhance the chance that at least one will take, right?
Correct. The more embryos you implant, the greater chance you have that at least one will take. The techniques for in vitro fertilization, though, have greatly improved over the years. And so now the risk that too many may take is a significant risk.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your case, I think all three of you said that you actually wanted to have twins, right?
We did.
Yep. Correct.
Okay. Were there particular reasons for that?
Well, we wanted to have them to have built-in playmates, and this procedure is so expensive, you don't want to do it twice.
Okay.
Well, we couldn't afford to do it twice.
Uh-huh. The other aspect is we weren't getting any younger, and we didn't want to be waiting another year or two or three to have a second child come along.
Because this process can take a long time from start to finish. I mean, you may try several times before it takes. A straight couple might, too.
We started working with Growing Generations the week before 9/11, so mm-hmm. September of 2001, and the girls weren't born until 2 years later, mm-hmm. two full years.
Yeah, it's a major process, you know, financially, emotionally, just time-consuming, all kinds of things. So I would concur that for financial reasons, also just because of our ages and our interest in having a family with two children, we were predisposed to like the idea of twins.
Mm-hmm.
But that also does increase the risk of potential complications of the pregnancies.
Now, I mean, first of all, just for full disclosure, I'll just let listeners know that I happen to know all three of these men from running clubs. They're Gary and John are both in the San Francisco Front Runners, and Ed is in the East Bay Front Runners. And so, you know, you're the only two. I don't know anybody else personally who's gone through having surrogate, the whole surrogate mother thing. You're the only gay men I know who've done it. So I know that a lot have. But
well, apparently there's been, my understanding, I may be wrong, but my understanding is that there's been about 10,000 of these births in the United States. All of have occurred within the last 20 years.
You mean surrogate motherhood births or specifically for gay men? Okay. Oh, 10,000. Where did you get that? Do you know where that figure's from? Because I tried to track it down. You mentioned that last week, but I couldn't find it.
I think I was told that by the agency.
Okay. But then this is, again, you mentioned the name of the agency in passing, but it's Growing
Generations.
Growing Generations. And this is not an endorsement necessarily. John and Gary didn't have particularly fond things with them, but they are the largest one out there that is working with gay men.
There are many agencies for surrogates, and surrogacy is still more common, of course, in heterosexual families, where for one reason or another the woman can't carry the child. But yes, Growing Generations, I believe, is the largest agency that specifically works with gay male couples or single men.
Mm-hmm.
There are other agencies as well, and then there are agencies who work principally with heterosexual couples, but who also work with gay couples.
I did find an article in the LA Daily News today that referred to another place down in Southern California, but that it says that many surrogates, this is again a quote from the LA Daily News from March 2007, many surrogates actually prefer working with gay men, mainly because they don't have to tiptoe around a woman who suffered from infertility. And one of them said that she didn't think she wanted a relationship with the children in some way, and that not necessarily all of them do, of course. But she said she'd worked with a heterosexual couple. She was worried that she wouldn't have a relationship with the kids if she'd worked with a heterosexual couple. She said the woman might feel threatened by me and cut me off completely. So that might be a little bit off topic. But did you find that, like, in the case of your surrogate mothers, did any of them, did they want to work with you specifically because you were a gay couple, or do you think they cared one way or the other?
I don't think she cared.
Why do you think she wanted to do it?
To help an infertile couple, because she had worked with a straight couple before, and that did not result in a pregnancy or a child. And so next she helped out a gay couple.
Yeah. Ed?
I had the sense, although interestingly, we really haven't specifically spoken about it together, but I had the sense that she picked a gay couple, and exactly why she did that, I don't know. And it's interesting, that thing you brought up about, not having another woman in the equation. But certainly women who elect to work with an agency like Growing Generations that target gay couples is obviously choosing to work with a gay couple. I think the motivation of the surrogate, it is really interesting, and it's sort of the issue that most people, or the question most people have in their minds is like, what kind of a woman would do this? Mm-hmm. And that certainly was in my mind before I entered the process and the questions I had for the agency. And, grew to understand that better during the process. But it's certainly women who I think first and foremost really like being pregnant, but don't necessarily want any more children in their own families. You do have to have had children yourself in order to be a surrogate. They won't allow you to be a surrogate unless you've already had children for obvious attachment reasons.
Mm-hmm. And we should also bring up for the people who are listening that in this day and age, more than 90% of the pregnancies through surrogacy, it's a separate egg donor from the surrogate.
Right.
And the women involved in donating eggs certainly have a different set of motivations in general than the women who are willing to be doing the hard caring for 9 months.
Right. Generally, the surrogates, they like being pregnant. They don't want children themselves. And then it's the altruistic motivation of really feeling like they have a calling and really helping people who are infertile for one reason or another. And then really third is for financial considerations, whereas the egg donors, I think financial considerations are much higher on the list.
More like the primary.
Primary, and then, also the interest in trying to help people out as well.
You're tuned to Out in the Bay, Gay Radio for San Francisco and beyond. I'm Eric Jansen. My guests are Gary Bushell, John Cruz, and Ed Sweet. We're talking about gay men using surrogate moms to bring their children into the world. Let's just talk about the legal stuff for a minute or two. Do you know, first of all, do you know who the biological father of your two kids are? And you don't have to say so if you don't want to on the air. That doesn't matter so much. But what I wanted to know is, are there legal reasons not to officially know which one is the biological father of each kid? Gary?
We don't know which one is the father of which kid, or if one father both of them. But it's neat to see them develop and see their faces and compare them to their cousins. And based on that, we have guesses about whose child is whose.
John.
And just jumping back to the actual question, not as much a legal issue, but an insurance question. I mean, early on, when our girls were born in Alaska, only one of us could be declared the father. And if we had been forced to do genetic testing, which is what Growing Generations said would have to happen, if they had actually found that I was the father both genetically, I would have had to be the father. And my insurance was really lousy. And we were lucky that Gary, who had very good health insurance, could just be declared the father of both of them, and then I went through a second parent adoption.
Okay, so that was a big scare for you, that there was fear that you, that Alaska law might be different enough that you would have to be, there would have to be genetic testing to know who the father was.
Yeah, and yes. Potentially this, I mean, partly because the girls were so premature and so small, they were covered by a federal program that's administered by each state, so a lot of the health care was covered. But potentially we were at risk for tens, if not even hundreds of thousands of dollars of health care costs if I had been declared the father.
Ed, did you have something you wanted to add to that? Or?
Just our situation was a little different. We actually do know who the genetic fathers are, and that was done principally for legal reasons in our situation in the state of Oregon, at any rate. Our understanding was that we needed to let them know who the genetic father was, although no real proof of that had to be shown.
Okay.
But nonetheless, we did determine who the genetic father of each child was.
They were born in Oregon.
And they were born in Oregon.
So this is very shortly after the birth that you had this determined somehow?
Correct. And then the genetic father was put down on the original birth certificate, and then legally the mother, the surrogate mother, was also on the original birth certificate and then subsequently gave up her parental rights, and a second parent adoption was performed. And that's the way most surrogacy arrangements are handled today in the United States, is my understanding, with the exception of California, where in some circumstances a pre-birth decree is made by a judge. But that has not necessarily stood up in court, and many gay-friendly lawyers don't advocate taking that route.
Right. Okay. Because it's a much more dicier. There's some question about how the highest court might participate if it went that far.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about some of the personal reasons why you chose to have your own children rather than adopt? Anybody? Gary?
I wanted part of me in my child. Very selfish reason.
Fair enough.
Well, I mean, one of the reasons is one of the things you sort of highlighted early on, that sort of ironically all of us had medical complications. But looking at the children, particularly in this country, that are put up for adoption, some of them are completely healthy, happy kids, but a pretty significant number come from mothers who are doing drugs or had other medical problems or psychological problems. And I mean, part of our own experiences shows you'd never know what you're going to be getting into with the life of a child, but a lot of the children who are available for adoption are already coming with built-in problems.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean they can't be wonderful, loving children, but it's an added, being a parent is difficult enough, and if you don't want to increase the difficulty of it, I think it's reasonable to not go with that option.
Fair enough. Did you have something you want to add?
I think having a genetic contribution to the process was appealing. I think there are also other sort of practical reasons, having a controlled pregnancy where you knew what was going on, being involved from the very beginning, where sometimes with adoption, certainly you're not involved usually during the pregnancy, and often you may not even get the kid until they're older.
Mm-hmm. And probably more likelihood of a mother changing her mind, too.
There's also those domestic adoption. There are many sort of horror stories about, mothers who change their minds. And my understanding is that the mother has up to 2 years sometimes in order to do that. And then international adoptions, very hard to adopt internationally as a gay couple or as a single man. My understanding is it's almost impossible. So there are practical considerations and emotional considerations.
And I'd also bring up one thing that wasn't a consideration, in that many of the friends we have who specifically adopted, gay friends who adopted boys because they felt they didn't know how to or didn't want to be dealing with girls. And for us, we were happy to have either boys or girls, or mm-hmm. so we weren't trying to select the gender, whereas with adoption, that's a way you can go if
right.
you know you only.
Uh-huh. You brought in an audio tape, which I asked you to bring in because it's referred to in the book, and that is when Gary was up with Veronica and Zola in Alaska while they were in the intensive care unit. John had to stay here in San Francisco, so he sent this audio tape for Gary to play to their daughters so they'd get used to his voice. And this is an audio cassette tape. It's old and hissy, so we'll crank it up a little bit. But listen to that, and that's how the girls were first introduced to John's voice.
Once upon a time, there were two little girls. Their names were Zola and Veronica. And they were the cutest, prettiest, smartest, nicest little babies in all of Hobbiton's Hospital. At least that's what their daddies thought. But they weren't the happiest little girls. Even though everyone was nice to them and fed them, and smiled at them, and sang songs, and washed them, and did nice things for them. No, they weren't the happiest little girls, even though they were pretty happy, because they still weren't home. So they were sitting in their isolate one night, and Zola said to Veronica, "I want to go home and be with Daddy. How can we get there?" And Veronica looked around her, and she saw a Canada goose who was getting ready to head south. So she said, "Mr. Goose, can you take us with you when you go south so we can go home to San Francisco?" And the goose said, "I'm so sorry. I'd really like to fly south with you, but I don't think I'm strong enough to carry two little babies like you. And besides, the airport officials would ask me if anyone's given me any object which I haven't packed myself, and I'd have to say yes."
Okay, that was great. We're so close to the end. I would ask you to read more, but I do want to ask before we leave just a tiny bit about getting married. You two got married, and your book ends, Gary, with an appendix about marriage. And you guys got married, and was it partly having because of that thing, that's part of the reason I'm getting their names messed up. Zola and Veronica. Yep. Zola and Veronica. It was part of their coming into your lives that you decided to get married, was it not?
It was. Just to be a family, a real family in the eyes of the law.
Yeah. We met in 93 through Front Runners. We had had a commitment ceremony in 1998 at our fifth anniversary, so we felt bonded and together, but with the girls, so many more things became important to be that they'd be legally and officially recognized. So when Gavin Newsom, in February of 2004, which is half a year after they were born, created an opportunity, or at least we thought it was an opportunity, we sort of jumped at the chance to make it an official family.
Great. Thank you very much. You've been listening to Out in the Bay, a weekly show about gay life in San Francisco and beyond. I want to thank my guests, John Cruz, Gary Bushell, and Ed Sweet for coming in to share their personal stories. Gary, where can people find your book, Papa and Daddy and Babies in Alaska?
They can find it on Amazon and also in the Castro at A Different Light and Books, Inc.
And if you want to get a little more information about this topic, growinggenerations.com, also rscbayarea.com, which is Reproductive Sciences Center. Out in the Bay is broadcast every Thursday at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday at 2 p.m. We archive our shows on our website, outinthebay.com, where you can now also subscribe to weekly podcasts. That's right, free weekly podcasts, outinthebay.com. Our deep thanks to Rob Yonker, Ted Wigga, and the whole team at WY Enterprises in San Leandro for donating their time to revamp and maintain outinthebay.com. Business and personal services, wyenterprises.com. Our thanks also to the staff and management of KALW and this week's studio engineer, Joanne Marr. Out in the Bay is independently produced by me and Marilyn Pittman. We'd love to hear from you, so please drop us a line at outinthebay@yahoo.com. I'm Eric Jansen. Thanks for listening.
This is 91.7 Information Radio, KALW, San Francisco.